Welcome to the podcast From Depression to Expression. I'm your host, Oliver Schirach. I have struggled for many years with low energy, self-worth, and depression, which have hindered me to truly live my life and express the beauty that is within me. To help myself, I started to learn a lot of things. After many years, I feel ready to share what I've learned with you. You're at the right place if you want to find out more about what is depression, what can cause it, and how to get out of it again. It's either for you or for someone you know. We will be going out into realms that are not yet accepted by mainstream. We will be talking about the effects of food on your emotions, being unaware of your emotions, shadow work, triggers, soul retrieval, awakening, dark night of the soul, near-death experiences, and much more. Some of those shows would be just me talking about things that are on my heart and what I learned lately. Other shows are with guests from around the world, which will share their knowledge with us and broaden our horizons. Those guests can be scientists, shamans, medicine men or women, therapists, personal coaches, and of course people that went through depression themselves and sharing their experience, what they learned by finding out who they are. Follow me on this journey to learn more about how to overcome depression. Learn to accept and love yourself truly, so we can embrace our authentic self unapologetically and start expressing who we are without fear, but with joy and lightness. Please remember to like and subscribe to never miss an episode, and share this episode with someone you know that needs to hear this information. So without any further ado, let's get into today's show.
Alrighty. Okay.
Okay, we are recording. We just had some introduction on how we are. This is Oliver Schirach, your host of From Depression to Expression. And we have Cara Mayo. Did I say it the right way?
Sure. That's sure. Good.
That's good. Yeah. We had two calls at least beforehand and getting to No, Cara, and that's an amazing story. So let's see how we are wrapping it in this interview. You see, for the ones who have the YouTube, or I've heard the Spotify video coming. So if I'm on Spotify, then you see the paintings behind Cara. So she has been painting all her life, and I'm sure we're going to get there. You're sitting in the US and you still have sunlight.
Yes.
By now, I just have darkness on the outside. So for me, it's evening because it's winter time. It's the, how you call it in English? Raunächte. It has to do with the Scandinavian god Odin and, you know, the nights where you're going to smoke the houses, right? With all these different incense to get rid of the bad energies. And Odin is hunting with all the people. Ah, yeah, and the deer with the sun is going down to hell and then comes back up. So it's like, I think these next 20-some days, 14 to 20 days are the Raunächte. Yeah, sorry. Don't know the English word.
I don't either. I don't think we have something like you do that's about with the incense and certain things. Not as much.
Yeah, it's the Nordic, northern, you know, traditions with Odin, Thor. I mean, people know Thor, right? Avengers.
Yeah, and Odin. Yeah.
So for the young listeners which have never heard about the real story, it's a bit different than on the Marvel universe, but they took a few of the things right. So it's just the shortest nights of the year, basically. Darkness in Scandinavia. So, Cara, before we go deep into your story, let's warm up a bit for the listeners who have never heard you, perhaps also for people that know you. How would you describe yourself in three headlines, words, and also describe why you would describe yourself with these three headlines?
I'm somebody who is interested in expanding my consciousness and hopefully sharing that through creative aspects, predominantly painting. So that's my focus. What else did you want to know?
Yeah,
why was this? Why in
like
there?
Like three headlines, right? So it's like,
oh, three.
So one is interested in expanding your awareness mm-hmm. with painting.
Yeah.
And the next one?
What also comes with painting is a way to connect with not just my inner world, which leads to the larger outer world, but it's a connection with nature. So both of those things, the natural process, let's say all three now, are important to me. And also finding places to just be and connect with people and kind of share who we are and have a synergistic situation occur, kind of make magic happen. I like doing that too.
Yes, and then he just gave me another question. I try to write them all down so I don't forget them, because there's a lot you can share. So, and there you said paintings. Because you're a painter, my favorite question from my other podcast, the Oliver Schirach Show, it's if you're a new color in a coloring box, what new addition to the coloring box are you, and why are you that color?
I see myself being surrounded by and swimming in cerulean blue.
Cerulean blue.
Cerulean. Well, it's like a turquoise. To me, it feels very fertile. It feels like a color of creation. And also, you know, mixed in that is that what I think of it as the plasma of the universe, which is like all colors. So it looks like it's crystalline white. So that's mixed in with the turquoise blue that I feel surrounded by. It makes me happy. So that's my color box, pretty much.
Because it makes you feel, yeah. Wow. Is that, I can see you have a t-shirt on, but that's not that blue, right?
That's close enough. I mean, I see a more vivid cerulean blue, but yeah, this is a lighter tone. Yes.
And the stone you're carrying around your neck, what is that? Is it just a
crystal? You know, so this is an interesting thing, is that I was drawn to a small rock show, and I met a man that lives in the U.S., but he's from Morocco. And he got a limited small number of stones, that's before I polished this, that he said were from the Mid-Atlas Mountains in Morocco. And that he got them from a friend, and it was an odd thing. It was like a deep depression where they found these, I'm going to call them stones. It's soft, and it almost looks like glass, although it's not, because there are all these little bubbles. And it actually has its own smell. But what's really interesting about it is that I have a friend who's very, very tuned into rocks, which I feel I am also. And I showed her a picture of these raw stones, and they're softer, more like glass. And she said, would you please pick some up for me? They're very powerful. So I have some, I sent them to her too. And I feel like they have some kind of celestial connection, because they're not stones and they're not glass. And there was never a settlement up there. So nobody really knows what this is.
Oh, so they're not crystals in that matter.
No, there's all these little tiny, tiny bubbles in it. It's really fascinating stuff. And I feel the energy from it. To me, it feels celestial, like it's, I don't know what, but it's an unknown stone.
Unknowns. Now you just make me like, I want to have one in my hands just to feel it.
Yeah, it's an interesting stuff, and I don't know what it is. Maybe someday I can have it tested. So
who knows what happens with it.
Yeah.
Have you ever used it as inspiration for your paintings?
I would say it's inspiration for life. What seems to happen without my thinking about it is when I have somewhere really important to go to, like into the mountains or to some kind of happening, I'll hear, take me with you. So I do. I either wear it or bring it.
Wow. Interesting. Yes, yeah. That's good. I have a few different necklaces and stones, but I haven't really used them lately because I pushed them a bit away to make room for all the Lego sets for my son on the window frame. So they're not visible right now. So what I normally did is just take one or two stones and put them in my pocket. Whatever felt right to have with me. And I have one necklace from my sister, and the stone inside has been the same type of stone has been used from Napoleon to help his soldiers to be cleaned kind of from energies. So I didn't know that Napoleon was using crystals.
No, but, do you know what kind of stone?
I do not remember it right now, okay. What it's called, but I can find out for you, I guess. It's a black stone.
Tourmaline, maybe? Black tourmaline?
Yeah, but I think it's more like, it's not a crystal, so it's...
Hematite?
No, okay, no, it's not one. It's not one of those. It's more like, how you say? Like it's from, it looks like a volcanic stone, kind of like, which is kind of, when you put it in water, it's cleaning. Kind of like, so it's very light. But we're going to look at it afterwards because...
Okay.
I guess otherwise it's going to be boring for the listeners when I'm going back and forth and trying to figure out what it is. So that's something for the after show, only for people which are supporting us have access to the after show. Perhaps in the future, I could think of that to open up after the interview. People can throw in their questions directly to us and we can help. So these are the first two questions I use. And then the third one I use, a fun fact or secret not so many people know about you, if you're up to it.
Mm. Well, that's a good question, Oliver. Fun fact or a secret? I'm stumped, honestly. You know, I don't think I have secrets, but there are things that I don't talk about because there just isn't a place for it.
Perhaps we are stumbling on a few of those points during the interview, which, you know, I don't know how open you talk about near-death experience we talked about, right? Your accident, being present, your encounters with different native cultures from around the world, and you know how your intuition has brought you there, basically being present has brought you there. So perhaps those are the stories, right?
Yeah, it could be that. I'm finding that I'm getting a confirmation. Like last night, I went to a fundraiser at the museum that I have my artwork hanging in, and I was seated at one table, and I got there and I just was going to take one chair and my intuition said, no, sit here. So I moved over one seat. And then I realized as the evening went on that the person presenting was actually standing right next to me to my left. And there was a something that was covered that he was going to reveal that was very important. And that's what I ended up sitting next to. And I consider that all an energy thing because what he revealed was a very important old manuscript. And there I was sitting as close to it as I possibly could without knowing it was even there. And it helped me realize that I have a tendency to, without thinking, find the energy and just go for that energy. And that's how I ended up in that museum. And because I didn't know anything about the Russell Museum. So, you know, it's an interesting thing that I'm paying more attention now to where I find myself and looking around to recognize more consciously the energy that's there.
Huh. I guess that's a reminder for myself to be more open for those energies, because since I'm married, since I was married and kids, etc., I'm kind of closing more down again instead of just, you know, going. I guess for me, exactly what you described makes it so difficult when I go for vacation and any place. Last summer we were in Cyprus in 2020. I simply could not look at what to do. I'm like, Cyprus has so many energy points. I have no idea what to choose. So I will just feel my way in. But my ex-wife, she just wanted me to kind of help her to plan everything.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I said, I need to feel the energy. I need to feel the place before I can. And sometimes I beat myself up for it, right? Like, oh, why didn't you look up before so you can find out all the attractions, the zoos, the museums, the whatever places to visit? But somehow, probably that's for me the same, right? The intuition says go there and you will find, if you listen, you will find the right places to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or you can do it both ways. I mean, you could even plan, I'd like to see that mountain or whatever it is.
Exactly.
And when you get there, you watch where your feet take you.
You know, on the other mountaintop.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the things to get my mind out of it, is I watch where my feet want to take me. And then I just go there and look around. But the other thing also, when you mentioned you're not going out as much now, is that you can do that with your internal quest, is just to say, okay, you know, where's a good place to go to today? What's important for me to investigate for my highest good? And do your meditation and see where you end up. Or even set it up more by taking a book that you really love. And randomly picking a sentence or a paragraph and saying, that's where I want to go today. So
yes.
It's endless.
Yeah, I've been struggling the last 2 months, actually, since I broke my hand, to in the evening just sit down and read a book. It's my procrastination during the day. And then in the evening, like, oh, I wanted to do all these things. And then you make the plans for the next day. Next day, you wake up and you have no energy. And then in the evening, the same, instead of, you know, exactly as you say, take a book and just enjoy. So, but we neither talk about weather as we did before or book reading. I'm trying to figure out how we best go through this talk, because we can go chronologically through your life experiences, or we can just take it on the energy levels. I mean, how we connected and how we started to talk from was your experience. It's kind of started with a car accident, right? And then we went back and forth in what happened before, what happened as a child, what happened afterwards. I think let's take this car accident situations. Like, where have you been in life before the accidents? You know, what was the energies and the events happening, and then what happened? And then we take it from there.
Okay, well, I'll do a brief jump because it gets too boring if I go into it too much. But I'll just say something that set the tone of my life was having a child near-death experience around the age of 4 and a half, where I had my tonsils removed. And looking back, I grew up in a very loving, supportive family. But having that child near-death experience, which was lovely, I, as a child, subconsciously walked away from that feeling like I was rejected from being with these loving beings on the other side. So it left that subconscious feeling in me about not being good enough, because I didn't get to cross over. Yeah, it's interesting, or even I don't want to say a sense of betrayal, but just being pushed away from these loving ancestors on the other side. So that was kind of a start for me that I didn't know anything about. And then as a child experiencer, PMH Atwater, who's done research on NDEs, says that children, it's the loss of innocence. This is before the age 5 and younger. And the child starts taking care of other people. They're very mature for their age. And that I believe that's exactly where my life was going up until the adult near-death experience in 2004. So as a child, I think I saw too much and I knew too much, and I had to shut that down to survive because of the sensitivity of it. And I thought that I was here to take care of other people. And it wasn't until the car accident that I realized, no, that's not really my main focus here. It's just the overshadowing from the child near-death experience put me there. And as I've gone now through healing from that car accident, the traumatic brain injury, and the near-death experience, I realized that this focus on freedom and vastness that I feel out in the universe or on the other side, whatever words you want to use, is where I really get excited. And it's something I want to find a way to portray and share, especially now.
Yeah. And for the listeners, you had contact shortly with the other side on this tonsil removal near-death experience, and you felt like they said, no, it's not your time. So that's the rejection you felt. Just so it's perhaps yes. helping the listeners which didn't really get it, what does she mean? So that's enough to know, right? Like, to kind of have the contact and like, no. And then as a 4.5-year-old having all this love, unconditional love, that's what you hear a lot of people which had this near-death experience. Also the people I talk to, they all say this: there's this love, this unconditional love and this warmth and this welcomeness. So it's really hard to go back to our world, which mm-hmm. which is very materialistic. And some people call it heavy and dense because things are moving slow. And you say you have seen too much, right? But on the other hand, there's also kind of like a little bit of magic. But you know, like seeing, hey, there's magic. There's another side which we don't see, or most people don't see. So how was that for you? I mean, did you believe more in these magical stories you hear as a kid, or did you reject them?
No, I did. I really believed in it, and it became. You know, another world, another space, which is why at that age, I mean, most kids like art, but I really focused on art and animals and pets and nature. That was the best place I could go when I was younger. So that yes. continued.
Yeah. So art and animals, how was your connection with animals? Because now I just got this week a video from a guy which said he had a hard childhood, but luckily he grew up on a farm with lots of animals, cows and horses and pigs and everything. And he's teaching this respectful connection with animals. So how was your, mm-hmm. your experience as a kid with animals?
Oh, I was fortunate because my parents were fine with different pets, that I could have different pets, and that worked. But I want to share something else that was interesting is that when my son ended up with a puppy that his girlfriend at the time picked and brought home, but her parents said, no, you can't keep the puppy. And the dog was a mixed wolf and German shepherd. And yeah, she was fascinating. And when my son was at college, he lived at home, but I was in charge pretty much of taking care of the dog. And she was fascinating, you know, just really interesting. I took her to obedience classes and different things like that. And it became a partnership. She would let me know when she'd had enough. And I had to honor that because there was nothing that would force her to do anything. And once we had a relationship where we worked together, it was very, very magical. So I still think of her, you know, a very special, wise being.
Wow. So a wolf German shepherd. the wolf inside her was the one you cannot really bend beyond the free will. So did you learn a lot about yourself establishing this cooperation between her, like this bond?
Well, I had a lot of trust. I learned trust working with Nara, because she was very sure. She was an alpha. Her personality was an alpha, and she would let me know instantly if enough was enough. And the way she would do that, she had really strong jaws, like wolf have, you know, strong jaws. And she would put her her teeth on my wrist. It was never a puncture, but she would put her teeth on my wrist, and it would almost, she just hit it right where it would almost be numb, like she'd do that. And then I would know, okay, we've reached our limit. She's not going any further. And that was her signal to me, I'm done, you know? So she was a very steady, calming influence in working with another feminine, you know, energy that perceived a lot of things that I didn't perceive.
Yeah.
So
I'm actually not going to call my dog. I think she's now on bed somewhere. Sometimes she's behind me, but she's a German Shepherd, Husky, Border Collie, looking wolfish. But she's not that big. And she was also very intelligent. So it's very interesting when you share this. She's a big mirror for myself. And many people tell me, like, you have to learn to see yourself in the dark and see your energy so you can learn about yourself more, you know, to calm down. That's why I ask. So then the other question while you were talking coming up, right, is do you have any, you know, like the right word, spirit animals or totem animals or energy animals or whatever the words are that you're aware of?
Well, definitely the wolf. I've had people say they see the wolf around me, which is interesting. And hawks and eagles. So, you know, kind of, I've had experiences in different ways with, you know, different animals. But I'd say those three are the top ones.
Interesting. Interesting. Very similar to me. I just have more the jaguar and the black panther, tiger in it as well. Yeah. But the wolf somehow doesn't let me go, even though I don't know why. And the eagles, when I look at drawings as a kid, there was the jaguar I was drawing and eagles I was drawing. And then later on the tiger. Not so much wolves, but I'm fascinated by these Native American art with wolves, right? Necklaces and other things, drawings. They just draw me. They're fascinating me. Plus, I like wolfish dogs.
Yes. And, you know, have you looked at some of the cave paintings in different cultures? Because the way that animals are shown is interesting. You can really feel something of the archetype of that animal from the cave paintings.
I haven't really gone deep into looking at cave drawings, paintings. Mostly I know the ones from Northern Africa, right? Where you have bison and stuff like that. Or bears, you know.
Yeah.
Cave bears, mountain bears, or whatever they were called, these huge ones. I was once in Romania where they found this, you know, cave with the, how do you call them? Stalagmites, you know, the
water. Stalagmites. Yes.
Stalagmites. And they found a few skeletons of cave bears, which are huge. So,
wow. So
we were able to look at them. They got captured because the mountain collapsed and they were inside the cave sleeping. So they all died.
Hibernation, right?
We don't know if it was hibernation. We just know that the entrance was blocked because of, you know, could have been hibernation, could have been hiding place and thunderstorm and the hide and then it collapsed.
Yeah, interesting.
So, but yeah, that's interesting. Now, we haven't talked about animals before, so that's nice. let's go. So the first near-death experience was at 4.5. I haven't really talked besides you with anyone which had such an early near-death experience. We know people being traumatized by operations at the age of 3, 4, 5, you know, ear operation, tonsils, whatever not. Some people call it like loss of parts of their soul. If you listen to Sandra Ingemann and so on, which can happen at that time. And now when you were much older and you had a car accident and you were in a big change of your life before that already. So, and you know, what put us on the stage there?
Do you want to know about the near-death experience, the adult one? Is that what you'd like? Or?
When we talked about it, you shared me that in your life, a lot of things were falling apart. And it was a new, your life, the life you had until there was falling apart. And then you had a car accident. I think they're somehow related, right?
Yeah. Well, so the first thing was my mother died and I had a very strong connection with my mother. So whenever I would do traveling, I'd take pictures by postcards, but I would see things and send them to her in my head. Look at this, Mom. Look at that. And then when I got home, we talk about it. So I always took her traveling with me. And when Mom passed away, that was, you know, that was a difficult thing. And then just after my mother passed away, a 30-year relationship ended. And that was traumatic. Plus, my sons both went in different directions. So it was the breakup of a family. And so that part was difficult. And I was living in Norfolk, Virginia. And I remember doing a painting and saying, Mom, where can I find you? And I ended up doing a painting of mountains. And, you know, it was really lovely. And so at that point in time, I was living near the water, nowhere near mountains. But I went with a neighbor of mine to take a class in another state that I was hoping with this class that I could start a business. And it was during that time that the car accident happened. And I don't have a memory of it. I just went from feeling really good because we had a great class and I was thinking about my mother. And then the lights went out and I lost a chunk of time, but I had the near-death experience. And in that experience, my mother and my aunt, who had died recently, both showed up. And my mother said, Kara, everything is going to be fine. So I heard that and I got all the visuals. I mean, what I could share about it that was so interesting is that it began, the NDE began with my being in a state of blacker than blackness, but it felt wonderful. It was buzzing and humming with fertility, all possibilities. It was an exciting place to be. And I went from that, and it felt like kind of a nubby blackness, for lack of a better word. It was a place of creation. And then I went from that into a more refined blackness that was just much lighter. And I was in that state of the blackness, the more refined one, where I started wondering, you know, where are my hands and feet? I don't feel them. What's, you know, I'm not feeling my body. And I was drawn to like a spot of light, of consciousness, let's say, that I knew was me. And then at the same time, as I'm realizing I'm a spot of light, I looked down and I saw this vast ocean of waves lapping and moving. And on the crests of these waves were these beautiful pinpoints of gemstone-like colors on the waves, just moving and moving. It was mesmerizing. It was really beautiful. And I realized that, wow, I have a color too. Those are souls on those waves. And I started to look down to see what my color was. And that's when my mother and my aunt came up in the scene, and I ended up looking up at them, and behind them was a sunset. And I started focusing on the sunset behind my aunt and my mother because it was just calling to me. And I was ready to go there. And that's when my mother said, Care, she called me Care instead of Kara, everything will be fine. And then I was right back into my body. And that's when I woke up in the emergency room. So when I woke up, that's the only thing I could remember was that near-death experience, which I feel very grateful for. Because when I came back, I felt the pain in my body. I had a few broken bones. That wasn't the big deal. It was the brain injury. So that was extremely painful. So I would say the thing that helped my helped keep me in the game from that brain injury was the knowledge from my mom that I would be all right. It's just I thought it'd be 6 months down the road, not 14 years.
Yes, we talked about it. That's why.
Yeah.
I also say the whole talk we had from depression to expression, it's kind of like the whole story there from these 14 years of dealing with a head injury, and you sometimes still are dealing with it, I guess. Mm-hmm. Not as bad as before. That's hard, right? But you had this vision or this message from your mom, everything will be fine. How did you feel during this 14 years? Was it depressive or?
Yeah, well, it was a mix of a lot of things, Oliver. I had to wade through a lot of things bit by bit. I couldn't rush my body. I did use, I had some friends that did alternative medicine that helped me. I really wasn't capable of doing very much myself. For 10 years, I meditated 6 days a week. And then suddenly after the TBI, all I could hear was screaming in my brain nonstop. There was no way to get away from that. Because your brain is saying, tilt, something huge is wrong, watch out, don't do, all these fear messages that were constant. And there was, at that point, there was no way to escape that. So one of my pet peeves is when people tell caregivers, say, to traumatic brain injury people, well, meditate. And it's like, no, you can't. I couldn't. I shouldn't say you can't, but I don't think it's just me. Your brain gets stuck and there's a lot of fear in there and it keeps recreating that. So how do you stop that constant fear? So anyway, yes. Oops, let me decline that. Okay.
Yeah, you're back.
Sorry about that.
No worries. Yeah.
Okay.
But the question for me is like, what kind of steps could you take to slowly get better? I mean, now you say you have all these fear messages. This is, I think for me, when you're depressed or stressed or traumatized, you have these fear messages without a brain injury. And I guess for me, unfortunately, I wanted to meditate much more now in this period since I broke the hand, but I didn't. And I can imagine when you all the time have this, you simply, how do you become still? Or what were you able to do? Did you look for your nutrition? Did you have massage? Did you have acupuncture?
No.
What was helping you?
I wasn't well enough to do any of that. I ended up sitting in a chair, embracing the pain because I couldn't cope with light. It didn't have to be sun. It just was too, my eyes were too sensitive. My hearing, I really couldn't cope with hearing the birds chirping. That was too loud. So between the visual and the audio, and then what do you do with yourself? And I was constantly nauseous and dizzy for 2 years after the accident. So getting up and walking around was a definite trial on top of a screaming brain. So the only thing I had left, I think, was to go in and embrace that, what was there inside of me, that pain, and to be with it and to have a realization that that's really all I had at the time without knowing it consciously. So I spent a lot of time being in and embracing that pain and that shouting and just being with it. It took a while. You know, I did make myself go out and walk, and unfortunately it was in the winter time in upstate New York, so it was frigid, and I lived right next to, not on, but very close to a lake, so the wind would blow across. So the best thing I could do at that point was to smother myself with essential oils, wear super heavy clothes, and walk as far as I could walk before I felt too dizzy, or I didn't feel it was safe to walk anymore. And then I would go home. So that's pretty much it. I did have people stop in to see me, but there wasn't much that I could do, really.
Yeah, now that you mentioned the people coming to see you, that was in my head just before you mentioned it, but how were the people treating you or feeling around you? I mean, I can see when I was in the peak of my depression, people just start to go away, right? They don't want to call you back. They don't want to talk to you. It's always negative. It's, you cannot do anything. And so how was it for people to be around you when you were not yourself, right? You were not.
Yeah, it was very hard because what happened in my family with my close family is that they expected me to step up and do what I was doing prior to the accident. And I was a kind of a big caregiver at that point. They expected me to just step up and do it. And when you look at somebody who's, you know, I didn't look that awful. I mean, they couldn't tell by looking at me what was really going on. I unfortunately didn't have words to say to somebody, you know, I don't have words, or I shouldn't be driving, or any of those things. That didn't even occur to me because I was hanging on so tightly to just survive. And it wasn't until I was very fortunate. I ended up going to a teaching hospital, and they had me work with five different people. And one of them was this fantastic psychologist who said to me that everybody that he had seen that had traumatic brain injuries felt like they should just get up and go back to their life the way it was, and that they didn't look hurt. You see somebody with a broken leg, you don't tell them to go run down the street, you know, because you see that, but people don't see where you're injured. And he said, it is very common for loved ones, people closest to you, to expect you to step back and do what you were doing. And he said, just tell them, I'm really sorry that the car accident I was in has created these problems for you, you know, in terms of what I can do. So it's an interesting thing. I had a talk with my brother, let's say about a year ago, where he said, well, I didn't know you were that bad. Why didn't you tell me? And I said, because I didn't have words. I couldn't find words. So when people have no idea what's going on with especially a traumatic brain injury, their expectations of you are way bigger than what you can actually even think about. So I was a disappointment to people that had constant expectations. I had people that loved me saying, well, just tough it out, just move through it, just get yourself to do blah, blah, blah. And one of the things I had to do, because I was living with a friend at the time, I had to drive, it was a 30-minute drive, and part of it was on an interstate to get to the hospital. And I went to see a neuro-ophthalmologist because my eyes weren't working well. And she said to me, you really shouldn't be driving. She said, your eyes are moving like a camera back and forth, in and out, constantly. And I said, I have no way to make appointments if I don't drive, you know, to her and then to the hospital. So she gave me some glasses that would help focus my eyes in and told me to be really careful, that I really shouldn't be driving. But that explained to me why I had less than 2 hours a day before I had really bad headaches. And so when people would say, you know, kind of tough it out and push yourself, it's like, you know, I'm lucky if I have 2 hours a day without being in constant head pain. I wasn't even able to use my eyes after 2 hours. Read two sentences in a book and my eyes went crazy. How do you explain, which I didn't have the ability to, but how do you explain to somebody, I'm already maxed out, you know, I'm doing the best I can. I didn't have words to say that or to even explain what I was seeing and what I was feeling. So I'm sure that was similar for you with depression.
Yeah, not as bad, but I definitely can see when you're depressed, things just don't work, right? It's not like you have headaches or focus issues, but I'm sure some people, what you said with the eyes, I've heard from another person, he didn't realize why he's so stressed, right? Because his eyes were also going back and forth, up and down, and just to get a picture because he didn't see enough. And then he was constantly stressed because his nervous system was overloaded just to be able to see. And he didn't understand that. But in my case, for me, that's very difficult to explain. Like, people just look at it like, yeah, but you did this and you did that. Why are you not just doing? I'm like, I don't know. But there's like this invisible force which keeps back. Of course, when you talk about it, you reinforce it, right? We know all this thing, Joe Dispenza, Greg Braden, and all these people, Michael Beckwith, and don't talk about it, or NLP coaching. Talk about the good things, right? So if you talk about it, yeah, I'm stamping in my own way. I don't have the energy. I'm procrastinating. And I do not understand. Then, of course, you kind of reinforce that. In my case, this was something mental, right? Something I should do was not met. But how do you explain that you don't have energy to do anything? How do you explain that you wanted to kill yourself today and you just didn't do it because you have a family and kids and you didn't want to leave your wife with two kids at the age of whatever, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 years of age, and you come home and the only thing you could do was just laying in bed and you could just barely manage to pick up the kids and go back to bed because you cannot move anymore. Physical pain, and you cannot really get up of bed, and you want to make cake and you want to make a nice dinner, but it's too much. You cannot focus. Like, okay, I'm making a steak and then I make a salad and I make some vegetables and I make a cake next to it. So where do I start? It was just too much, simply too much. And people just look at you like, you look healthy. You have big muscles. Yeah. The muscles don't just disappear because you have a bad day, right? So, but for you was, of course, a longer thing. You had a head injury, your eyes were getting crazy, the light was too much, the bird sound was too much, you know, you were dizzy. I mean, that's even worse, much worse. So, but you said for 2 years you had like this conscious nauseousness and all these things around you. Did it get gradually better afterwards because you were moving a bit and you tried a bit? Were you able to eventually go back to meditation? Or
so it, as my brain started healing or healed to that particular point, that's when the dizziness and nausea stopped. In the meantime, in the very beginning, I was using essential oils because I didn't have anything else, Oliver, that was supportive to me. I couldn't go out in nature. I did every so often, but I felt so sick that I wasn't out there long. And I was just trying to hold on so I could get back home. There wasn't anything to look at or listen to that made me feel better. So I found the essential oils were the biggest support that I had at that point in time, and I still continue to use them. And I think you mentioned something about, you know, what was your second question about timing or healing?
Yeah, it was basically the first 2 years you had this nauseousness, and then, you know, how were you able to do other things afterwards? No. You know, because it was 14 years and you said the first 2 years you had this constant nauseousness, so your brain was healing. So there's still 12 years until you made a bigger step. So what happened? What happened after 14 years after your accident that you say, now it's better?
Well, I moved out of the city. I was living in Metro DC for the, I have to think of it, 6 years or more. But I realized that I was going downhill and doing worse. I mean, some parts of my brain were healing, but I wasn't coping well with all the noise, all the stress. And I realized if I didn't try to live in a quieter place, that I didn't know if I would survive, or I didn't think I'd do well. So a friend helped me look around, and I found an area to move to near the mountains, near the Blue Ridge Mountains, and moved to a place. So I didn't know anybody, but it felt like I had to start somewhere. So that was when I started turning a corner. I'd also been listening to the medical medium said that when you have stressed adrenals, which I definitely did, about having something good to recharge your body every 90 minutes. And he tells you what, like apples and celery and stuff. I started doing that. And I also, prior to moving, had access to using a Serigem Qi bed, which is far infrared heat that goes along your spine and hits acupressure points. Those things helped me boost myself enough to make the transition. I also worked virtually with a TBI doc in California. And through, I was able to afford a certain number of blood tests where he prescribed supplements to help the brain get back online. And that was a big help. It was too expensive for me, but it got me started. So that was my big jump to try to turn things around. So when I got to a quieter place, I did finally start to relax and find more sleep. But I would say that it's been within the last year that I've been able to meditate, and it's still not at the depth that I used to meditate at.
Yeah, that's there's a lot of things in meditation and other questions I have now. So when we had the last two talks, which were not recorded, sometimes I'm like, might have been good. You were talking about, you know, living in this with this injury made you shift, right? One thing you said, the injury, that's also why I asked you what was your life like when the car accident happened. And you also told me the last time you were in a shift, not only, as you said, from, you know, husband and kids and your mom died and all these things, but you were also, the new job you took was not allowing you to paint as much as you used to, right? So it's kind of also like you've been able to paint afterwards, after this injury, still to some degree. And what was the other question which came in? Ah, yeah. How you went through the life. I mean, you could not, you said you could not go out and pay because you could not focus on counting and make the calculations on how much you should pay for things and other logical thinking. So you had to really rely on your being in the present moment and on your intuition.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate a bit on these things?
Well, as we talked about before, the only thing I had was my intuition, because my brain, my thinking brain, wasn't working. And I would find myself standing in front of a desk and look down and notice it was a bill for my phone. And then I'd pick it up and I'd write a check and put it in the mail. That's how I paid bills, was if I just happened to see it. And to even know if I needed to move money from my savings to my checking account to cover these bills, it would be if I looked down and saw the checkbook, and then I would pick it up and do what I needed to do. So the interesting thing was that I never ever bounced a check or did anything. I mean, my intuition kept me in the game enough to pay my bills and to take care of the things, you know, pay my rent, the things that I really needed to do. But one of the stories you referred to, there was a small grocery store just down the block from me, and I couldn't count money. And going into the store, the fluorescent lights drove me crazy. So that's part of the whole healing part, between fluorescent lights and even looking at phone screens and computers. The oscillation is something that my eyes felt, so that I couldn't be in that or any store for very long because of the lighting. And that's before even hearing all the sounds from people or air conditioning turning on and off or whatever it was. So it was an extremely fearful situation to go into a grocery store. So I would take a $20 bill and kind of run in there and grab some vegetables and then just go to checkout and hand them the 20 and run out. No matter how much they cost, I obviously didn't want to go over the $20 mark, but I couldn't do money. So that's, that stopped me from doing any kind of shopping or going to places.
Sure. So you were not depression shopping, or like feel good shopping, going out and buying all kind of things to make you feel better. Extra no. Shoes, extra purses.
Nothing. I mean, it took me a while because I had so many challenges driving to even get in the car and drive places, to keep my eyes focused enough to be able to drive somewhere. And I kept working up to going to this mall where there was a clothing store. And I would drive there and sit in the parking lot and then go home. And I kept doing that over and over until I was okay to drive, because my fear was that I would run out of the ability to focus my eyes and not be able to drive home. So I did that over and over until I felt like I could do that. And then I would walk into the store, and in the very beginning, I just walked in the door, looked around, and I had to leave. And so it took me a number of times to even get to a point where I could go into the store because of overload and drive myself home. That was a process to even do that. And then you can imagine the rest of the steps to even look for things that I might need and then pay for them. So I had to use that process. I always drove around with an extra change of clothes in case I went to visit a friend. If I didn't feel like I could drive home, I would stay at their house. And it, to bring it home more, is that one time I was driving home from a friend's house, and I went through a four-way stop, and I didn't realize I went through that stop sign without stopping until cars honked at me. But I never saw it because my eyes were shutting down from the strain and the stress of driving. So that was my fear.
Yeah. So we get a really big picture here of your pain, on the depression, on the limitations of your life. It's kind of like, I feel really heavy at the moment when I listen to that.
Sorry.
No, but that's my empathy, which I need also to learn to keep it outside, right? You just share it and you're over that. So basically what you say when we talked is also like living in the present now, because you couldn't really plan, you couldn't really focus, you didn't have the energy. So how was that a change to the life before the accident? You know, living with the intuition, right? That you saw something, oh, I need to pay the bill. And everything was paid in good time, so you never get ended up in trouble, but you couldn't really plan everything before because you forgot it simply. So that's like this intuition part, and in the present, you see it, I do it now. How is that compared to the life you had before? And what did it teach you?
Well, I think the life I lived before was probably pretty standard. You know, I think in a lot of, I mean, you know, what people normally do. I think I was functioning pretty well. I mean, I was under a lot of stress, and then suddenly life changed with the traumatic brain injury. What it taught me was that I really had to pay attention to energy in order to survive, not just mine, but the energy around me. So if I was walking down the street, let's say, and somebody said something to me, or I ran into somebody I knew, if the energy did not feel good for any reason, I allowed myself to just say, hey, I gotta go, good to see you, and I'd take off with no questions asked. I didn't have the extra energy to even question myself as to what's going on. Why did this feel not good to me? What else should I do, et cetera? I didn't have the energy for that. I only knew that if it felt bad, I had to leave because I didn't have that extra energy to force myself to be there or to troubleshoot. So what I did learn from that was to really pay attention to my energy. If I didn't feel good enough internally, I wouldn't go out. So, and I still carry that with me. I want to be in a better frame of mind, more positive energy if I go out, because not only does it have to do with my interactions with other people, but also with what you put out, you get back. And if my energy is crappy, I don't want to be stepping out into the world sharing that. So it made me spend more time paying attention to what I was putting out and where I wanted to be with my energy use and with other people.
Okay, so you're more conscious now about yourself.
Yeah, right.
And
what also, I put in.
Yeah, and so you're also more present now than you have been before.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. The last times you shared a lot of nice different stories of interactions with people that brought them into your life, or like you shared in the beginning with sitting on the chair. Obviously, we didn't talk about that because that happened between the last talk and today, where you had the book next to you. You shared this different interactions you had because you listened to your intuition. There were things with Aborigines, with Tibetan monks, and other Native Americans. How were these stories? Because I thought they were very interesting, you know, to listen to your intuition.
Well, I'm trying to sort through here. This was before the traumatic brain injury, but I want to share it because I think it's fascinating. I was a volunteer at a United Nations Indigenous Peoples gathering in Virginia Beach, and I was fortunate to meet an Aboriginal elder, and he brought with him a painting that was on canvas, but not on a stretcher, a painting of his ancestors. And every time he did a talk, and I happened to be there for his first talk because that was the lecture I was working, he said to people, he showed them, unrolled the painting and said, these are my ancestors. And I take them with me when I go traveling so that they can explore and meet people. He said, Aborigines are very touchy-feely people. And he said, if you'd like to meet my ancestors, you can lay down on the painting and just feel their energy and let them feel you, and then, you know, move on so the next person could try it. So I did that, and at the moment I was very busy. So in terms of did I feel anything, I wasn't paying attention. But the part that was very interesting is that less than a month later, I was in Sedona, Arizona, and looking at this beautiful landscape with valleys and mountains. Whoops, I got to decline that. Sorry. And I felt these on my left side, like five pair of eyes staring at this landscape, and I, you know, feeling it. And I did one of these, who's here? And I, you know, without talking. And the realization was that it was this man's ancestors that I had met through the painting. And they were like, just, I felt their eyes just looking at what surrounded them. A lot of curiosity, some really pure energy coming from them. And for that trip, I was happy to have them look over my shoulder and visit some of the vortexes in Sedona, et cetera. And so after the traumatic brain injury, I'm going to fast forward, I felt them with me and asked about doing a painting. Was there something to paint? And I felt like they had some energy to share. So I did three paintings from feeling their energy that were very powerful for me. So, and I feel like they're still with me. I'm very grateful for that. So, and then, go ahead.
Yeah, so basically when you were laying on this carpet or painting, you were not really aware or not really present, but still it somehow rubbed off on to you something. So you still made somehow the connection.
Yes, yes, it did. You know, it's like ice cream has different flavors, the different energies that you experience, whether it's guides or whatever through your meditations, they have a particular signature that I feel when they show up around me. I feel that energy, and then I start looking in different places because that's sort of a signal to me. So it has helped me in my discernment also, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
So and currently you still feel them with you when you make paintings or when you do other things?
Well, I invite them in when it's time. When there are certain things that are coming up, either I'll feel them waiting to see if I want to invite them in, or I'll say, I'm doing this tomorrow night. I invite you to come in for it. So, yeah, it's that kind of relationship. So I really like feeling them there.
Yeah. I just looked at the notes I took while I was talking to you last time. And I remember that after your brain injury, I think 2006, your father was dying, right? So he died after. And you had a very close relationship to your father with thunderstorms. So your father taught you not to be afraid of thunderstorms, and you were watching them. So I think to remember you went to visit your father in the hospital or at home.
He was at home. He died peacefully at home. My brother and I were there, and some of my nieces. And when I got home after Dad passed away, my neighbors were standing around the front yard of the house that I was renting, and they said, it's a good thing you weren't here, because lightning hit in the front of your yard and it hit a power line, which would have landed on your car. And my realization was I would have been sitting out on the front porch during that thunderstorm, because that's what I sit on my dad's lap and watch them. And when the repairman came to fix the power line, he said, yeah, if you'd been sitting on the front porch, it would have stopped your heart, because that's how powerful lightning is. So the rest of that story is that there were some channels that were formed in the ground from the lightning strike. And on the top, there were all these little bits. They were like very small marbles of greenish. If I say glass, these, they're called fulgurites, petrified lightning. They're very fragile. So they're not glass-like, but they had a glassy surface. And my son and I collected all of them and dug everything out. And then it was years later when I lived in Metro DC that I brought them to the Smithsonian Natural History Museum, and they were very happy to get them and put them in a collection. And the geologist there said that the color, which is a deep greenish tint, and the all the little balls was very unique. That was not common with lightning. And my thoughts on that in terms of the soil and why the color was that way is that I lived very close to Onondaga Lake, which was a lake sacred to the Iroquois Nation. They considered it a lake of peace. So I think the fill dirt around the house I was living, or the dirt there, was from the lake, and that's why the color was like that. So the part that's interesting about fulgurites is that Tibetan Buddhists are I'll say they like lightning. They look for trees that have been hit by lightning and collect the bark. And I had been, I had joined a Tibetan Buddhist Sangha when I lived in Alexandria, Virginia, and heard this and made and painted a little box and put some fulgurites in it because the Dalai Lama was coming to town to do a talk. And I asked a translator who had come to our sangha to translate for a Rinpoche if he knew how I could get these fulgurites to the Dalai Lama. And he said that he did, and he would be very happy to make sure they got to His Holiness. And I thanked him. And then it was after the Dalai Lama's visit, I got a very short email from this man. And he said that the Dalai Lama was very curious and joy-filled to get this gift. And I found out that this man that was the interpreter was the president of the Tibetan Buddhist group in Washington, D.C., who had invited him to come and speak. So he was the perfect messenger to get that gift to the Dalai Lama. And then I went on to share some fulgurites with the heart sons of the Nyingma lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. So it's been wonderful to share that gift with people who really appreciate the fulgurites.
Yeah, the thing you also shared last time, the little box you were creating for the Dalai Lama, you just had this insight, right? You just felt like to draw some kind of a shape or symbol inside.
Yes, it was the Kala Chakra symbol. And I was looking for something to put on top of and in this box. And I saw this Kala Chakra symbol and painted it, and then found out later that it was the Dalai Lama's symbol, the Kala Chakra. I had no idea.
Yeah, intuition, so, right? So that's also why I mention it again. It's like this, your life was full of this intuitive hinges, and you followed them, and they brought you these wonderful things in life.
It has. I'm very grateful. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's. I have so many notes here. One more. So I have like. Where should I go? What is my intuition telling me? Yeah, I just see the word painting. So let's continue with the word painting, right? I take that as a hint. We planned to have an interview, but you had last week, you were placing a lot of paintings on a wall in the local museum. And you shared with me the story behind these paintings with, So how, what did you do? And I don't remember how long is it ago that you started to do this new type of painting.
Well, it was about 4 years ago when somebody who was very intuitive said to me, why don't you paint with a candle, you know, when it's dark out? Just paint with a candle, which, of course, you can't see with a candle. You can't see your colors. You just, you know, can find the palette and find the canvas and that's it. And I thought, okay, I'll try it. And at the time, I had moved. So I was in this area close to the mountains. And I'd wait till it was evening and it was very quiet. And I'd go on the porch, which was a second story porch, excuse me. And I would just tune in, because I have to step back and say, it felt to me like new energies were coming to the earth. So I would tune in to the heavens or to space and say, okay, what new energies are coming here? And then I'd paint for 20 minutes. And then the next morning I'd get up and see what was on the canvas. So the initial stuff I put down was kind of like a roadmap. And then I would sit down and tune in and say, okay, help me fill in the rest of the story. And it was very contrary to the way I would normally paint. I didn't get visuals. It's not like I saw the completed painting. I would hear, put deep blue on the left side of the painting. And I'd cover it with deep blue. And then later on, I would hear, now you need to put a white line going through here and here over the deep blue. Well, when you're using oil paints, that doesn't work. You get mud. So I'd have to take off the blue paint where I needed to paint the white and put it in. So it was a difficult way to paint, but that's how I got my direction. And I did that for I'm not even sure how long it took, but I ended up with 33 paintings. And then I heard stop with that. And then I got pushed to pick up and continue that, and did 7 more paintings that are 1 foot by 5 foot long, like banners. They're the ones behind me. And those paintings are more like archetypes with, let's say, nebulas or galaxies from the universe in them. So the 7 more recent paintings portray that. The initial 33 paintings all portrayed force and movement. So they show shapes and movement. And the way they appeared to me after I had completed them, I felt like a dynamic movement in each one, that I could almost step into it and feel the turning or the rippling or the movements of these symbols. So yeah, it's a different way of painting. And I also feel like they started to tell a story, a cosmology. And that's what I put together recently, is the cosmology, and it's hanging in the museum. So I still have more things waiting to paint that are part of this cosmology.
Okay, so the 7 extra paintings are the ones which are really physical now behind you, for the ones which see the video. Yeah. I don't know. I have this, I cannot help it, but one looks for me like the phoenix, for whatever reason. That's what comes to me. But I don't know if that is one of these symbols on one of these paintings. And another one looks more like a South American, how you call it, medicine man. The one with the yellow. Just how is it called? Yeah.
Yeah.
Ayahuasquero or something like
yeah.
that.
Interesting that you say that. Yeah, because I've experienced ayahuasca, and I have a friend who's a curandera. So, but actually, I'm really curious to get people's feedback on things, because, you know, I'm doing the painting, but I don't have all the words. I'm still looking at it. And feeling.
Okay, you look for feedback from us to give you words for the paintings, so you can describe them, or
more information. You know, because the first one that started this archetype series behind me was a from a connection, a realization of something. I had studied Western mysteries before the traumatic brain injury. And a big part of that was studying Kabbalah. And there's a hidden sephirth called Doth. And I remember one of the older occultists saying that Doth would be made manifest. So in most of the Tree of Life charts, you would see a dotted line, a circle. Well, dotted line showing a circle that signified Doth. So what came to me was, oh my gosh, you know, this is signifying that more of this energy of what the Tree of Life calls Doth is coming into existence right now. And that's what I started to paint. That was the beginning of it. Well, just recently, somebody took a look at the painting and said, you know, that looks like Kundalini energy to me. I thought, well, that's another way to express it, isn't it? You know? So that's why I'm saying everybody's input is very interesting.
Yeah. So that, yeah. So for me, it was like these two questions. One, the seven paintings behind you, these archetypes, what it means. And then of course the feedback you got in this, I think it's a week ago you hang them up. It's Friday today. I think you said Thursday last week you were done with rearranging them. You sent me a little video. Did you get any feedback on how the people experience it so far? I mean, not just with words, like you see Kundalini energy or from the Kabbalah. I didn't really understand what you said there because I'm not educated in Kabbalah. I know a bit. I've seen some documentaries, but it was too strange for me to really absorb it. I know that's what some people call this is the magic that really works. Even if you don't believe in it, it still works. But when I was thinking of the images, like really, like when you're there standing in front of that wall you created with all these paintings, how do people feel? Even people which are not interested consciously about those different, you know, teachings. I know the museum is from a man which has known Tesla, as far as I remember, right?
Yeah, Walter Russell.
Mm-hmm. He was a friend of Tesla and he founded that museum. So we know all Tesla had some, he used meditation to come up with ideas for his research, right? So I don't know if he was a student of Kabbalah or what he was. But then, so the museum, how it's functioning now, I don't know if it's... Who is going to that museum, kind of? What did they tell you?
We've been in a COVID period, and the museum, it's the Russell Museum in Waynesboro, Virginia. It just opened right before COVID hit. So in terms of the number of people visiting, it isn't that many yet. We'll see what happens. But Walter Russell started out as I think he was an architect, but he was definitely a painter and a sculptor that was very well known in the United States. And then, so he has a very curious life where starting at the age of 7, I don't know what happened to him, but he would go into meditations. And then as he got older, he started writing books from his sabbaticals, let's say, because they could be very long periods of time. And one of the books called The Universal One is the book that Tesla referred to when he said to Walter Russell that you should put this away for 100 years because people aren't ready for it. So
that's about now, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, and then it makes me wonder. But anyway, there, Walter Russell has written a lot of books, and actually Nassim Harriman, who's a very well-known physicist, considers Dr. Russell as one of his mentors from the science that Walter Russell put down. So the what I want to say, that there's actually a study class too. So people can look up Walter Russell and investigate his books and the study classes that they have for that. And it's very fascinating, and I don't pretend to understand much of what's written in the books because it's heavy duty science to me. But the museum is a place where I felt the energy strongly that it's an open place for ideas and creativity. And the people I've met there that work there have been wonderful. And that's kind of how my paintings being in the museum came about, because I stepped in and talked with one of the people there, and he found out I was an artist and asked to see my work. I brought it in. He said, love to have you put it on the wall. And it's on the wall. And so to answer your question, I don't know how people feel when they see my paintings, because first of all, not a lot of them have come through. And then the one person that works there, he said, I look forward to seeing your paintings on this wall because it feels like they belong here. And I feel like it's really good for them to be there, because I feel Walter Russell's creative energy in that room. So, you know, who knows, Oliver?
Yeah, so I didn't know that this, perhaps you mentioned it, but with all you knew in my space and all the information you shared, I might have forgotten that part, that the museum was just opened newly. I thought it was something which was established 20, 30 years ago. But so it's a really new museum. And of course, thanks to COVID, there's not so much traffic. But let's see how people will react on it. You know, standing in front of art sometimes creates something in you, right? It could be uncomfort. It could be comfort. It could be whatever different energies. And most of the time, art is meant to create a reaction in the person watching it, looking at it, experiencing it. So that's why I was curious, because you sent me the video and then I look at it on the phone. I'm like, yeah, that it's nice, right? But it's small. It's not the same as looking at it big. And there's all the details in it, the different lines and colors.
Well, I'm trying to think of the foundation that they've had for Walter Russell's work. That was, Walter Russell died in 1963, so the study classes were in existence well before that. So it's actually been, the books and the study classes have been going on for quite a long time, but the museum just opened a few years ago. So that's to put that part in.
Well, that's nice. So we know now you're there. And you shared with me before painting at night and not really seeing in the candlelight, the colors and everything, were more painting nature. You're right. That was more like landscapes and stuff like that.
Oh, prior to that?
Yeah.
Yes. Impressionistic landscapes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's kind of a cut from where you were before. Again, you listened to your intuition and you just followed, and it brought you to have an, you know, you have your paintings hanging up in the museum.
Yeah, I'm very grateful. Yes.
Yeah, and that's why I ask you, right? And the little store, whatever it's called now, the flash glass crystal parts which you gathered up brought you to give something to the Dalai Lama in person with the right drawing, and you got the feedback there. So it's like really this message of learn to listen to intuition, be in the present moment and just follow to this voice, the image, the pulling, do that. You never know where it's leading you. And and for me, it's, in my case, it has been leading me from one person to the other for interviewing. And I have a friend like, how do you find people to interview for your podcast? I'm like, I don't know. They just somehow appear. So that's perhaps my intuition is there. Like, of course, once in a while I get someone to interview, which probably is not resonating so much with me. And it's most of the time the people I kind of force into my field instead of just like, let it flow and then let's see how it goes. And then we just interview and right. And then the energy most of the time is really good. And when I really want to have someone in on my show, and I'm not really listening, it's just something in my ego, like, okay, that one will help me, then I probably have 4 or 5 downloads of that interview, and it wasn't feeling so easy to have the interview.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Especially with the subject matter that you're interviewing people about. It's really important, I think, to have your intuition working and, you know, to meet with that connection. And this has been enjoyable for me, the times that we've talked and shared what we've learned and what we've experienced. So I appreciate talking with you and being interviewed by you. So,
yeah, know. So let's we have 1.5 hours. We said let's go for an hour. Because you can hear my nose today. Yes. That's the second interview. And the first interview suddenly started having a running nose. So I can also feel it in my system that I'm slowly shutting down.
Yes.
Some kind of a winter cold or something. But we can, of course, continue talking afterwards. I just need also to go in the bathroom. The whole system is like...
It's time.
I think we've been going around. So let's wrap it up. Of course, there's more questions I have, but we can always take that later. It's in another interview when we know more about how people react on your paintings in life, right? When you get feedback. Hopefully we can send some people to that Walter Russell Museum.
It's the Russell Museum, but it's called the Russell Museum, but they can look up Walter Russell as he was an author, a sculptor, and a painter. And they'll find more information.
Yeah, we'll put whatever we can on the show notes to find there. But let's wrap it up, the whole thing, with the show title, From Depression to Expression. I mean, you have been definitely in a depressive phase with the car accident. And you shared with us the only thing that kept you kind of looking forward was the message from your mom. I do not know how to interpret the sunset you saw in the near-death experience, if that was the light so many people talk about, you know, if you cross that light, you're on the other side. Like, if anyone has seen the animation Soul, I think it was a Disney animation, the cartoon Soul, there you see like the path to the big light and where everyone is entering and then you're on the other side. Or if it was just a nice image you saw, but you came back with the message and you kept going through the dizziness of your brain until the brain kind of healed, as far as, I guess, your eyes were not shaking as much anymore, working as much, and you were able slowly to advance with different medications, with different supplements, with nature, with calmness, and eventually meditate again. So, I mean, that could be another topic, like, what is meditation? And you express yourself with, you know, with a new type of painting for you, with these energy paintings, the archetype paintings. So, you know, what is depression? What is expression? How would you close that with your words?
Well, first I want to say one thing. I never took medication.
Supplements.
Yeah, supplements. All right. Just to be kind of clear about that part. What I found is that when I start feeling depressed, I find something creative to do. It could be digging in the garden. It could be knitting, you know, something creative to do to be the opposite of depression. So I always have projects laying around to create something and to move myself into that part of my brain, let's say, or experience where I actually get excited or it's soothing. So that's my go-to for when I start feeling depressed. So I hope that's full circle enough.
Yeah, but because that's expression, right? From depression.
Yes.
So the opposite of depression is expression.
Yeah. Yep.
And you consciously are searching for that. Wow.
That's true. So can I do this just to end it, Oliver, is to turn my phone around and just show the painting I did on my couch.
Yes, yes. For the ones which will see the video, whenever I have my videos.
Okay, well, I'll turn it around. We'll do it fast because it's not all video. And then we can... Okay.
On the couch.
Yes. Yes.
On the couch itself, on the fabric of the couch. It's not a canvas you painted, but it's the fabric from the couch.
Yeah, itself. I reupholstered the couch and then I painted on it. So anyway, that's my end point for today's talk.
Can you explain? Do you want to explain what it is? I mean, for the ones listening only to the audio, perhaps you can get a picture of it and put it somewhere in the show notes or on the blog post. But it's like I see two wings and some kind of light in the middle.
So it's the light in the middle is the star Sirius. And the wings are supposed to be like the winged disc that the Egyptians showed, which signified Sirius, and Sirius was very important to them. And then I have other symbols going down in the center, which I'm still not perfectly sure what they are, but there's from Sirius, there's a lightning bolt and a pyramid, and then some infinity symbols that go go down into a waterfall of energy. And behind the pyramid, consider that there are spirals going outward and inward, and then just kind of smoke on the sides of I don't know, that's what it felt like it needed to be painted there. So
on a couch.
On the couch, yeah. Hey, that I've got a chair I'm sitting in that needs to be painted. I'm just waiting for the right visuals to say, put me here, and then I'll paint that.
About that, I got a Peugeot car because when I got divorced, I needed a car to get to work because, you cannot walk to work here. It's too long. Otherwise, I spent 2 hours in the mornings. And it's a black little car, and I just see these two Jaguar or Black Panther eyes on the front of the hood and the part of the nose. I just have to do it, right? But I hold myself back, like, okay, how do I paint it? The car is old, so it starts to rust and so on. So it's really just as experiment and see how it works. But this was the picture coming through me. I don't know how to explain it, but it's kind of like a picture, but also kind of a feeling, right? Mm-hmm. It's not very clear visual like other people see it, but it's kind of like, you know, a picture visual feeling things. So I think more of the car. I haven't had the idea of painting anything on my chairs or sofa or bed yet. So who knows?
Well, yeah, that happens in a studio. Sometimes you just get a feel for doing something and it has to be there. So Yeah,
exactly. And who knows, someone comes in and says, this is exactly what I was dreaming of. And can I buy it or can I expose it or show it somewhere? To close it down, do you have anywhere people can find you or your work besides the Russell Museum?
I have a website. It's caramayo.com. That's caramayo.com. And they can go there and have a look around. And if they have comments or questions, that'd be great. Love to interact. And I think that's it.
Super. Then I thank you so much for today's talk. And round from depression to expression.
Thank you, Oliver. I'm happy to be here and talk with you.
Goodbye for the listeners.
Bye.